just want to say for myself and for Sister Janet what a wonderful experience it is to be here, and what a wonderful way to end the year and to start a new year with all of you dear friends. And it touches our hearts, and we just feel so comforted in being able to spend this time with you. We focus our attention this time of year on time, don't we? Because we're witnessing the passing of time that's kind of silent and unobtrusive, and the time just keeps ticking on, doesn't it? And before we know it, why, one year is ended, another one begins, and before you know it, why, we're recycling the whole process again at the end of another year. But this will go on forever, I guess. I don't know how they will measure time 5 million years from now, but we're assured that it'll be here on the earth 5 million years from now and forever. And the Lord has established the process by which we meter it and measure it, and I don't think that will ever change either. We have the sun and the moon, which the Lord established as a means for us to measure our time, and other celestial bodies, and it looks like that this is a thing which is set, which will continue forever. How they will celebrate the ending of years and the beginning of new years in the future only remains to be seen. But I'm sure that probably we're setting the pace. The world is going to learn that a watch night service is going to be one of the most wonderful ways to measure time and to deal with time and to the change of time in the future. They haven't found that out yet, but they will one of these days. We'll help them, we can show them how to do it. And so, another year is beginning, another year is ending, and we want to consider some thoughts on time, what it has meant to us. Time has been a very, very important factor in, of course, God's plan, and it's been a very, very important factor in how he has dealt with his people, both in the past and at the present time. As a matter of fact, he develops his people using a process of time. Faith itself, and I think probably that's more or less how we will link it up tonight, because we find that's the way the Apostle Paul links it up for us in his treatise in the book of Hebrews, that faith itself really is tested by time. And the Lord proves his people by their fidelity over a process, sometimes over what seems to be a long process of time. Sometimes we wonder why the Lord needs to spend so much time with us, but he knows best. And sometimes it becomes evident that his way really is the best. But time proves all things, and of course his people have to be thoroughly proven, don't they? Those who are going to, for the forever of the future, be with him in the administration of his wonderful purposes for all of humanity here on the earth, and his other creations on other planets in our solar system, and out beyond that. And when we talk about time, we're talking about immeasurable time, and we can see it when we look at the sky. We're looking at immeasurable time that is immeasurable in our terms. If we look through a telescope, it even becomes more immeasurable, doesn't it? And so we measure even some of the smallest units of time and space and measurement in our solar system in measuring it against the constant of the speed of light. Light years, they call it. And we place some of these outer bodies in our solar system hundreds of millions of light years away, and the time that it takes a ray of light that emanates from one of these outer bodies, a galaxy or a nebula, to reach the Earth is called the number of light years away that it is. And our mind is of course boggled by these numbers. Computers can't handle them. So all of this really is represented in how God measures time. So we get some measure of the expansiveness and the extensiveness of God's mind, how great it is. And he can conceive of all of these things. We can only observe them and get some little measure of appreciation of them, but he comprehends all of this. He's the author of it. That's the reason the prophet Isaiah, in trying to give us some idea of how to measure the greatness of God, he uses his creative powers to measure this. And he talks about how that even with this, with our own little earth itself, how that God as the architect of it, and as the one who put it all together. He was the chemist that made it work. Of course, he had a lot of help too. He had those that were part of his staff, the angelic forces, the Logos himself being the chief one. But what is it Isaiah says in the 40th chapter of Isaiah? He says he measured the waters in the hollow of his hands. The creation was no great challenge for God, for his great intellect, that he could, and it was all finely tuned and carefully made. He pictures it that way. He measured the waters in the hollows of his hands, and he measured the dust of the earth and the hills and the balance and so on. How it was all carefully measured, and how the forces would keep all of this together and keep it working for these hundreds of millions of years, and we don't know how long. Before it's all through, and it never will be all through, it'll be in the billions. But how that there was no challenge to God. And I like the picture that he gives us there of one who is just sort of sitting at a workbench and putting this all together. And that's how great our God is, the one who has made time for us, the one who measures time, and who measures us according to his standards of time, uses time in the development of his people. And so time marches on, and it's going to march for a long time, isn't it? When we think, you know, it's hard to conceive of forever, of eternity. We really can't. It's sort of a word to us which means never ending. And one doesn't really describe or define the other. They're just interchangeable, aren't they? But when you look out at the sky at night, even without a telescope, and you realize that these little dots of light that you see are so far away, light hundreds of thousands, millions of light years away, some of them, and that what we see is mostly our own galaxy. Occasionally, why the light from another galaxy will pierce that of our galaxy, but we can't really detect it as another galaxy, but it's out there. They've numbered them up in the millions. When we think of how long it will take for God to complete all this, we don't know what he has in mind for it. If we would suppose that probably he has something in mind for it like he did for our own solar system, at least a little part of our galaxy, which is all the stars that we can see, plus a lot more. If we measure it by the little part that we're familiar with, which is this Earth, why, he must have a purpose, some purpose to have it populated, at least in a measure. And when we stop to think how long it will take to do all that, and we hope to be involved in it, don't we? So we'll be able to measure it by God's time clock in some distant time in the future. How long it'll take to do all that, to accomplish God's purpose for it. And maybe it is never-ending. Maybe it kind of folds back upon itself and recycles itself. And the best we can do in trying to describe our own galaxy, our own universe, rather, is the Einsteinian theory, that it is a sort of the balloon theory, that at times it expands like a balloon and it contracts and then it expands. It's all very dynamic and always in motion. I understand the only motion they've observed is expansion. Since the time they've been able to and had the instruments to observe it, they've just measured expansion. It was his theory that at times there's contraction, but he wasn't really sure on that. He had no observations to support it. The time it will take to fulfill God's purpose for all of that. if we can kind of determine in our mind what that is, I think the only word that we would come up with would be eternity. Gives us maybe some little tangible idea of what eternity would be like. So we're talking about things that are just too great for human minds to fully comprehend. We can conceive of them, but we really just can't embrace them fully and comprehend them. So what's happening now is that there is no change in this time. There's just a little change in how our time is measured in our little spot in that universe. And we thought we'd talk a little bit about time tonight as it relates to us and as it has related to others in the past. Perhaps base it on a statement that the Apostle Paul makes for us in the book of Hebrews. And it reads this way. 10th chapter of Hebrews and the 36th verse. For ye have need of patience. And that's what time really means to us, isn't it? It's patience. How important patience is in our Christian development. For ye have need of patience, that after ye have done the will of God, ye might receive the promise. For yet a little while, and he that shall come will come, and will not tarry. Now the just shall live by faith, but if any man draw back, my soul shall have no pleasure in him. The book of Hebrews was written primarily to describe what faith is and what faith isn't. And he uses practically the whole book to describe what faith isn't, and he uses the nation of Israel under their law covenant as an example of faithlessness, of infidelity. And we don't really like to analyze their example too well because it wasn't a good example. Prophet Zechariah, I think, referred to their existence under their covenant and how they related to God under that covenant as an example. I think we have to go to it's Rotherham, it's one of the other translations, that states this way, not in the King James, states it this way, like as I have made you an example of a curse. Their whole life and their whole existence turned out to be a curse under that law arrangement. And God purposed it that way, so that we would have an example of how God deals with unfaithfulness. And they, of course, God cursed them as a nation. And they experienced all the problems, the trouble, experiences that went along with a nation that was cursed of God and cast out as a nation. He says that in the future, he's going to make them a shining example of a blessing. And that this nation that God cursed and had well documented for the whole world to see and to appreciate how he dealt with them, that this same nation, he says, will be an example of a blessing. And, of course, we know that when God is dealing with the nation of Israel, that he's really giving us a little example of the whole world and how he deals with the whole world. The whole world was cursed in the beginning because of infidelity to him through our father Adam. And the whole world will again come back into harmony with him as a blessed world. And that the whole world will enter in as a prime example of how wonderfully God can bless those that are faithful to him and in harmony with him. And so the book of Hebrews sort of tells us where Israel failed and how that they shouldn't be an example to us. We shouldn't do those things that the Israel did under their law covenant and failed and were cast out from the pleasure and presence of God under that covenant arrangement. But in the book of Hebrews, in contrast with that, he shows us some shining examples of faith. And this is his prelude to it, the scripture that I've read, because from there he goes into the 11th chapter of Hebrews And there he gives us some wonderful examples of faith, examples of faith that we should try to follow and to emulate, and which we find hard to follow and to emulate. When we think of the wonderful faith that some of those that God dealt with in the past, which we like to call ancient worthies because they were worthy, and they certainly were ancient, we wonder if we had to endure the experiences that they endure, how faithful we would be. And we're not going to go on and mention all the things that Paul mentions here, but he goes on and tells how hard were their experiences and how difficult were their testings along the line of faith. But he mentions here, and we're not going to go through all of them except to handle them more or less as a group, we will pick out some that he kind of features here. First of all, he mentions about some of the early ones like Abel and so on. We want to particularly look at a little bit about the life of Noah. It was very unique, and it's a life that we can relate to, because as Jesus said, 17th chapter of Luke, he says that what happened back there in the days of Noah was descriptive or somewhat pictorial or similar. That's probably the better word. Was similar in certain ways as to what was going to happen at the end of this dispensation, the dispensation which we live in, a year of which we are now ending and another year of which we are beginning, all within this dispensation. Noah lived at the time when the Lord was ending a dispensation and beginning a new dispensation. It wasn't just a new year. They were celebrating a new dispensation. But it wasn't so much a celebration with them. He says, as it was in the days of Noah, so shall it be in the days of the Son of Man. He's pointing out that there would be a lot of similarities there. Somehow or other, we've gotten around to maybe only dealing with one or two of these similarities and kind of ignoring the rest. Not entirely, but I think sometimes we do, because generally speaking, and I know it runs through my mind that way when I think of that text, and I know it runs through other minds that way because they point out some of the problems that are in the world today and the evils that are in the world and the sin that is in the world and manifested by mankind today. They say, oh, it's just like the days of Noah. And that's what they feature, is the fact that Noah lived in a terribly sinful day, a terribly evil day. And the sixth chapter of Genesis describes it just that way. It says it was so evil that when God looked down upon the earth, that it says it grieved him at his heart. And I think it means just that. It was not easy for God to have, he knew that this had to be demonstrated. It had to be documented. It had to be lived through as to what the results of evil, just a little evil in the beginning, to what extent it would grow and engross and bring mankind down into degradation. And it did it in only just a few centuries. So this was an example of it. And it was not easy for God to cause his people, his creation, to have to undergo these kind of experiences. It says it grieved him at his heart. But he knew that it was, in the end, that it would be an advantage, an everlasting advantage to all his creation, not only to mankind, but to future creations, to the angelic creations as well, who played a very vital part in this, were very vitally interested in it, got themselves connected in it in certain ways that was not in harmony with God's will. So God saw that it was necessary for this to happen. It was in the best interest of mankind. It was hard for him, and certainly it was hard for mankind. So usually that's what we think of first when we think of the days of Noah, don't we? But Jesus didn't really emphasize it that way. He went on to say, and I mean, it was self-evident that it was an evil day, but as someone has pointed out, and I think that it was Brother Russell in the second volume, he says that isn't the comparison we should really make, because he says the world has always been evil, ever since it fell into sin. He says there have been very evil days in the past. Some of them eras of time that have probably been more evil than the era in which we're living in, which is the days of the Son of Man. It's just that they've enlarged, become more massive, so that they involve a much larger world and a great larger number of people, of humanity today, and so they become more, that is the effects of them, which is, of course, the trouble that we have on the earth. The effects of them become far more widespread. But we've always had evil in the earth, and those are very evil times at the end of that dispensation, according to Genesis, the way it's described there. And but he says we should emphasize that which Jesus emphasized, was making a point out of, that the people who lived at the end of that age, they didn't know it was an end of a dispensation. They didn't know it was coming to an end. They didn't know that the Lord was going to destroy that generation of people off the earth. And it was of their own choosing that they didn't know. Somebody brought up a scripture concerning the parallelism of that situation at the end of our age, and I think it was in Peter's epistle where he said, talked about those at the end of this age who were the scoffers, said, what are the signs of his presence, so on, how that they were willingly ignorant. I don't know who it was, but somebody brought that up in the one of the studies this morning. They were willingly ignorant back there, too. There's a lot of ways you can be willingly ignorant. It's just that God didn't keep them in the dark. Apparently, they were told what was going to happen. And when we read the story of it in the sixth chapter of Genesis, we get the idea, perhaps, that that might not have been true. But as we read some of Peter's commentaries on it, we do, because he says that they were preached to. In Genesis, it simply states that God saw the evil that was in the world, and it really begins by relating the matter from the standpoint of what the angels tried to do, and perhaps a program on the part of Satan to try to make himself look good in the angelic realm, but that God, look what God is allowing to happen in the world, he's not doing a thing. And look how evil they're dying and so on. And so the adversary says, I'm going to do something about it. I'm going to solicit your cooperation. How would you like to infuse longevity into the race of mankind and see what we can do to stem the tide of evil and stem the tide of death? That's kind of interesting that it had come to this, you might say, the psychological moment in time. The beginning of the chapter says, and it came to pass when men began to multiply on the face of the earth. Well, we don't know just how to interpret that in all its meaning. But it sounds like it reached a point where mankind was really beginning to multiply in large numbers. This took a while. This didn't happen immediately after that dispensation began, after Adam and Eve were driven from the Garden of Eden and they began to bring forth children. I figured out one time, and I think Brother Paul pointed out that these are all speculations, and nothing wrong with speculations, and thank you for laying the groundwork, Paul. Nothing wrong with speculations, but they're still just speculations. But we do like to kind of look at the situation, reason out. I was kind of interested at what the population of the earth probably was at the time of the flood. And, of course, you can go through the 10 generations that existed from Adam to Noah. And it says in connection with each one, it tells about how the first son that was brought forth and how old the father was at that time and how many years he lived after that. And all of this figures into the formula that you have to use. And even the formula becomes somewhat speculative. But it does say that each one brought forth a son, and then it says, and after that he lived so many years and brought forth sons and daughters. Well, if sons are going to be in the plural and daughters are going to be in the plural, that means two of each, at least, plus the one that is mentioned as the first son. And there might have been daughters even before that, but they weren't mentioned, as was
usually the case with chronicles in those days. So I reasoned that perhaps a very conservative figure of the number that they would have brought forth would be eight children. And based upon eight children, this was a long time ago, I'm not trying to recall what I came up with, but based on and projecting on that basis, on a factor of eight, I came out with a figure somewhere between 30 and 40 million people on the earth at the time of the flood. Now that might seem like a lot, you know, but usually we think of a little small spot in the earth where there's a little primitive type of city and Noah lived there, and but apparently it was more extensive than that. 30 to 40 million people, well, that's one of our big metropolises today. It's probably pretty much the size of maybe New York, Chicago, and Washington, and Phoenix. All combined together. That's quite a few people. So that's the kind of picture we get. Not that they had these big tall buildings and they lived in this kind of an environment, but it's a lot more people on the earth than I usually think of as being there at the time of the flood. So there was quite a generation there. The earth was becoming populated as you project ahead each generation. The rate of growth grows with the population, with the base population. And so by the time the flood came, we don't know how many people were being added to the human race on an annual basis. I figured out one time it was probably, on a yearly basis, it was probably somewhere between 15 and 20,000 people. Speculation again. But it was mankind was beginning to multiply on the earth. It could be said and observed. It wasn't just that one or two children were brought forth. So I don't think he was really talking about the beginning here. And that was at the time when, of course, the adversary thought, how's this looking? I'm sure there were people who died as a result of violence and that sort of thing. But how is this looking? I tried to sell the idea that men weren't dead. And, of course, he was trying to sell it to the angels, too, and that was a harder job. But now he was trying to sell them with the idea that maybe they didn't have to die. Maybe we could do something about it. Men were beginning to multiply, and he didn't want to rule over a dying race either. So he tried to do something about it. And so as the account goes on here, we do more speculation, and it seems that this was the point in time where God said, well, this is getting out of hand now. The point has been made, and if I let it go any longer, why, it probably will reach those proportions where it will be very difficult to recoup this whole situation in these people, maybe in the millennial processes ahead. And, of course, God had all these far-reaching view of all of this and could weigh it and see what would be to the greatest advantage of mankind at this point in time. And so he decided at this time that it was time to destroy the race of men off the earth and to save, of course, Noah and his family. But the statement he makes here, as he looked down on the earth, he says that he was only going to allow this condition to exist another 120 years. Now, this measurement of time of 120 years has come in rather prominently here in our thinking at the end of the age and trying to make these relationships from that end of that dispensation to the end of our dispensation. They've even been mentioned twice here at our convention. And, of course, some conclusions had been drawn from that, and those conclusions are rapidly going by the board. Somebody looked at their watch last night and said it's only a few hours and it's less now because they reached the conclusion of 1994, 120 years from 1874. Or 1994. But I'm wondering if the 120 years, and I'm digressing from my subject only because it came up, but I find this interesting. 120 years, was there really 120 years? We call it the days of Noah. 120 years of Noah. And so, since he says, as it was in the days of Noah, 120 years, So shall it be in the days of the Son of Man, 120 years after his second presence began to start. And of course we found through the prophecies of Daniel that 1874 is a very logical date based on the time prophecies. So, but is it the days of Noah? There's no real way we can connect it here. He says he's going to allow the Nephilim to exist only 120 years. The children that was brought forth by this experiment of the adversary and the angels that were with him. But when we go on here, we see some things that might indicate that the 120 years is not a valid length of time. I mean, it's a valid length of time, but a valid length of time to associate with the days of Noah. It goes on here to tell us that when God spoke to Noah about this situation and first told Noah that he was going to destroy this generation for the flood of waters, and there again we find that there were some parallelisms between the end of that age and the end here. God's statement to Noah is, the end of all flesh has come. Now he says all flesh, he was not just talking about Noah and his family and the human race then existing. He's talking about all flesh. That was animal life too. The end of all flesh has come. Because in dealing with that, and of course it becomes more pictorial as you go along, he saved animals on the ark too, so that all flesh, even the flesh of animals, would be saved. Jesus made a statement concerning the end of this age. He says, except those days be shortened, no flesh would be saved. It's quite an interesting parallelism here in these expressions. When he said all, no flesh would be saved, probably, just like the case of Noah, he wasn't talking just about mankind. He was talking about some sort of calamity that would result as the climax of the time of trouble that would destroy, had the potential to destroy all flesh. And of course we know that exists in the earth today, doesn't it? This was part of the message that Noah had to preach, what God had told him at that time, the end of all flesh has come. It's part of the message that we have to preach here at the end of this age, isn't it? Except that we have a sequel to it that is far more promising and far more happy for us to tell the people than it was in Noah's case. All he could say, the Lord says, the end of all flesh has come. We can say, Jesus said, except those days be shortened, no flesh would be saved. But he assures us, just for the elect's sake, those days will be shortened. Ours is a happier message at the end of this dispensation than theirs was, than Noah's was. But so we see those parallelisms existing there. And I guess the point I was trying to reach was this, that we take the ages of Noah's sons when he made that statement. The statement was a peculiar statement. Ninth verse of the sixth chapter, he says, the 18th verse of the sixth chapter, he says, but with thee will I establish my covenant. He told him that he was going to destroy all flesh with a flood of waters. He says, but with thee will I establish my covenant, and thou shalt come into the ark, and thou and thy sons and thy wife and thy son's wife with thee. And I find that kind of interesting because it seems, might not be absolutely true, but the gist of this is that these were all alive and part of Noah's family at the time the statement was made. Otherwise, he was telling Noah something that Noah didn't even know yet, that he had three sons, or that his three sons would be married and have wives. So we would reason that this was no surprise to Noah, and so that the three sons were already born, they were old enough to have wives. Well, this becomes interesting because we know that the oldest son was 100 years old when the flood came. So we say, well, this is the first statement that God made to Noah about this, that he was going to destroy the earth with a flood of waters, and here he gives Noah instructions as to start building an ark. Well, Peter doesn't leave us in darkness as far as his description of the day of the Lord is concerned. It's in the 1 Peter, I think the 3rd chapter. He talks about the days of Noah and associates it with the building of the ark. He says, as it was in the days of Noah while the ark was a building. So here he associates the building of the ark with the days of Noah. And the days of Noah, if they're associated and limited to the time when Noah became aware of the fact that the flood was coming and started to prepare for it and build an ark, that was the time when Noah first received the statement. So how old was Shem then? Well, Shem had a wife, and he was the oldest. Japheth, I guess, was the youngest, and so we'd say, well, how old would Japheth be? If he was the youngest, what would be the... We're only trying to figure out minimum stretches of time here, not maximum stretches of time, but what the minimum possibilities would be. We'd say, well, Japheth probably would be around 20 years old, and probably the three sons, the least that they could be apart in ages would be about 2 years. So it would make Shem probably around 25 years old. Now, this would be the least. Now, Shem might well have been 50, but we're trying to get the least stretch of time in there. So Shem could have well been, probably, couldn't have been any younger, probably, than 25 years old. Well, if he was 100 years old when the flood came, it had to be a stretch of time of 75 years from the time the statement was made until the flood came. Now, if Noah had to have his three sons help him build that ark, and we believe that he did, then probably... And why would Noah start building the ark before he knew a flood of waters was going to come upon the earth? It was at that point in time that he began to demonstrate his great faith in God to do something about something that was going to happen quite a long time in the future. He didn't know when in the future, but he showed his faith in God and began building that ark. And that's how he really, in a way, that's how he was really a preacher of righteousness. The rest of the world scoffed at him. Peter mentions the fact that at the end of this age, it'd be the counterpart of those scoffers at the end of this age who would scoff at those who were saying, well, where the Lord's present, you know, and this age is winding up and all of that. So, I submit that probably there was a stretch of time of 75 years to build that ark from the time that Shem was 25 and until the time that he was 100 when the flood came upon the earth. We know that he was 100. Shem was born when Noah was 500 years old and Noah was 600 years old when the flood came. So Shem was 100. And we've got to deal with that stretch of time, because that's when Noah knew he had to build an ark. And it was only 75 years later when the flood came. So I submit that the 120 years that related to the Nephilim and not to the days of Noah while the ark was a building. Well, I digressed, didn't I? And I'm not sure what time it is now. Paul goes on here to mention many others in the past who were wonderful examples of the test of time, having their faith tested according to the test of time. Noah, as we know, his faith was tested, and it was true. The flood of waters came upon the earth, and Noah was saved out of it. And so we have Abraham that's mentioned here. We know certain promises that God had made to Abraham and how there was so long in having any kind of fulfillment in his life, the long wait for Isaac and so on, that this was all a test of time, testing their faith. And yet they were faithful in that test. They proved worthy in that test. And all of these that are mentioned here, Moses and Sarah, and Abraham especially, and all the others that are mentioned here, and of course representing the whole ancient worthy class, they were all of those who in some way or another proved worthy through this testing of time. But the Apostle Paul is directing these words to us, and he says that since this is God's method, that we can expect to be tested along the lines of time. Now, when God made a, when we made a covenant with God, like those men back there did, but we made it along the lines of God's purpose for a new creation. When we made a covenant with God, it was a thrilling experience for us, and it was such an elation that came into our life, you know, and being the children of God and being able to be recognized of God and to commune with God in prayer and realize that God was dealing with them and to see His holy influence of His Holy Spirit in our lives directing us and bringing us to more greater appreciation of the knowledge of the truth and so on. And you say, well, while we were at this height of ecstasy, someplace in Scripture is referred to as our first love. And most of us went through that, didn't we, in our Christian experience. Why didn't God just end our lives right then and there? We could have just waited and gone into the kingdom. God knew that that wasn't enough, that our lives could only be tested through endurance, through the test of time. And so it is that most of us, all of us, in fact, have had to live this life of faith, this life of sacrifice. We've had to endure it for many, many years. God wasn't satisfied, wouldn't be satisfied that we would qualify to serve in His kingdom, in the millennial, messianic processes of His kingdom, unless we were thoroughly tested along the lines of time. Would we flag? Would we tire? Would we give up? Would we become discouraged? Would we, after a while, in seeing our own inability and our own strength and in our own resources to live up, especially when we begin to grow older and our physical resources begin to dwindle and so on, and we perhaps can't be quite as active as we would like to be in the service of the Lord, that we'd become discouraged and give up and begin to wonder whether, you know, when hard experiences came into our lives, whether the Lord was really still dealing with us, or whether we would be like these examples that He shows us in these men of old. And He goes on to say that, talks about all of the things that they endured, and you know the scriptures. I can't just find them right off the hand, right off the bat here with my eyes. But He says that they looked for these things in the future. They knew that they were future. They were a long ways off. They looked down the corridors of time like Abraham did, and they saw a city whose builder and maker was God. And it so inspired them in their lives then, even knowing that this would be hundreds of years, maybe thousands of years in the future. You think that, well, why am I serving my life in the way I am with all of these difficulties and this sacrificial way now for something that is so far in the future? But they were just so thrilled with the little vision of what God had for them and for the world in the future that they continued to live their lives out serving the Lord no matter what hard experiences that came their way. Read sometime, and I'm sure you all have, what they endured. I wonder how well I would have fared in enduring these same hardships for the Lord. And so, but the apostle is telling us about their lives and pointing them up as examples that will give us strength and give us faith to endure, not for just a few short weeks or months, even a few short years of wonderful elation and the wonderful things that God has promised for us and for those that love Him, but through a lifetime of laying down our lives in sacrifice for that cause. That's how He tests our faith. And that's the test of time. And it involves, for the most of us, most of our life, many, many years. But speaking for myself, and when I do, I think I speak for all of you, we wouldn't have it any other way, would we? It's been a wonderful year, of continuing to lay down our life and sacrifice for the Lord and the wonderful cause of the truth. And we can look forward to another wonderful year. And if the Lord desires to keep us here for another 10, 15, 20, 25, maybe 50 years, I don't think 100 is perhaps very reasonable. I'm sure that we would all rejoice and we'd say, praise the Lord, we'll do the best we can. And so this is a wonderful convention to renew our desires and our convictions to be of service to the Lord and to be a shining example in our lives, even as those ancient men of old were in their lives, of the test of time, a successful example of the test of time. Not like Israel, but like those who were chosen out of Israel as special people of God.